Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Richard So. He is Assistant Professor of English and Cultural Analytics at McGill University in Montreal, Canada. Previously, he served as an Assistant Professor of English at the University of Chicago, where he co-founded the university's first digital humanities lab. Textual Optics Lab. Broadly, he works in the fields of cultural analytics and American culture, with a particular focus on race and inequality. Increasingly, he also works on the internet and social media. His first book was Trans-Pacific Community: America, China, and the Rise and Fall of a Cultural Network. So, Dr. So, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show.
No, thank you for having me, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Okay, great. So, so let me just ask you, maybe my first question would be, what does the study of literature and literary studies have to gain, with the application of computer analysis and even maybe some techniques from AI?
I think the main thing that this discipline, which is a very old discipline, it's one of the oldest disciplines at the university, has to gain is I think a few things. So this is itself a significant debate in the humanities in terms of traditionally we study literature and culture in a particular way, more historically or through close reading of individual text or groups of text. And so, there's this question of exactly what do we gain and what is the purpose, and is it even appropriate to study literature and culture through the lens of data? I think that there is a few relatively co convincing arguments, in my view, for the usefulness of these new methods. One argument is that humans inevitably are limited in terms of how much material they can read or how many movies you can watch. And so historically, the study of culture and literature has focused primarily on analyzing very closely a handful or a finite number of kind of masterpieces of film or literature and culture. Whereas with data, we can really look at culture more at scale, so at the scale of tens or hundreds of thousands of texts. And this allows us to see patterns of meaning of language that previously we weren't necessarily able to see just because of the inevitable limitations of what a human can process or analyze. So one important argument is just a question of scale, that we can now study culture more at scale.
Yes, I am sure that probably many people who used to do literary studies or study literature and other mediums, artistic mediums, for example, using, let's say, close reading, right? That is the person itself or herself reading the text and extracting meaning from it and making several different connections, that they might have some criticisms of this approach, right? Because they might say, for example, that machines are not able to capture, for example, the essence of the text or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's in terms of the current debate, because none of this is really at all settled in the humanities. I think that's really the crux of the debate. That I think a lot of people have strong opinions that there's some kind of essence or ineffable meaning that inheres in a literary text that precisely can't be quantified, that only a human can understand, because works of art are meant to have a certain impact on the human reader or human viewer. And so it's kind of a paradox or a contradiction to use a computer to help a human understand a text in that way. To me though, it's really just different goals for different kind of analyses. I don't think really a computer can tell us why a poem is beautiful or not. And that's a kind of inherently human subjective judgment. But if our question is looking for patterns of how, say, women are represented over 100 years of films or novels, it's a different kind of question. And for those, I think a kind of quantitative computational method can be very effective.
So it also depends a little bit on the types of questions we want to answer, right?
I think fundamentally, and I think this is something that other disciplines like political science or biology, which have earlier adopted quantitative and data-driven methods that you know, political science has, you know, theoretical questions and more normative type problems. I think data is really good for tackling questions around things that can be quantified, like elections or whatever. But in terms of political theory, right, that stayed relatively non-quantitative because there are different kinds of questions. So to me, I hope that literary and cultural studies can start thinking about an array of different kinds of questions, some which are theoretical, you know, effective or really subjectivist, others a little bit more at scale or requiring more material. So yeah, I really think it comes down to different questions. Yeah.
Yes, because for example, if we're trying to say if a given poem is beautiful or not, maybe or probably a machine can't do that, or some sort of program or algorithm, but maybe if we're trying to answer questions that have to do with using literary sources to better understand how certain social phenomena developed or evolved, maybe we need more objective data points and also some mathematical modeling.
Right. Yeah, that's really my perspective, and I find that position pretty convincing. It's also a question of matching our claims to the right kind of evidence. So I think cultural analytics people, one thing that they are critical of traditional literary studies, that literary studies and cultural studies have not in the past shied away from making very broad claims about the impact of literature art on society, which have not been, in my view, well supported by the evidence. So trying to make, you know, really broad claims about culture kind of like, say, changed in the 1950s based on just, you know, readings of just a handful of texts. I think that kind of work can be very effective, but it might be also be a mismatch between the claims and your evidence. Whereas now we can make claims like that, that, you know, like say in America in the 1950s, culture became more psychological, more inward, rather than basing that on just, you know, the reading of a handful of movies or novels. We can do that potentially more rigorously and at scale. So that's also an affordance.
I'm not sure to what extent, for example, the types of mathematical approaches and things like that that you have, mathematical analysis that you have for literary studies, for example, to what extent they are developed. But for example, let's say one of the topics that you study is race, right? And I mean, with things that have to do with culture, we have to be a bit careful because, I mean, they are not, many times people use language not in a literal way. And I mean, for humans, and particularly humans that are included in a certain cultural framework, it's easy for us to extract the correct meaning. But maybe a computer program or something like that would have a harder time doing that properly.
Yeah, so this is actually material that I've been working on, really focusing my attention on the last few months or maybe half year, that I think, you know, more fundamental questions of, you know, what kind of language does a bestseller versus like a science fiction novel use? I feel like that's relatively more straightforward compared to using these tools to analyze racial language or gendered language or how women write versus men write. It's in my mind, as you're pointing out, the question is extremely difficult for a couple of reasons. One is in terms of race, there's a long history of using scientific methods to validate, promote racist ideologies. So, you know, the bell curve, eugenics. So that's the first reason we need to be very careful. The other thing though, which is more substantive, is that inherently racial categories and even gender categories are social constructions. They're fluid. So whatever and empirical quantitative methods are, they tend to be very rigid. They rely, you have to categorize things. And I think humanists are more interested in what we call deconstructing racial and gender categories, looking at how the categories are contingent or incoherent. Whereas again, a quantitative method requires that you use, you know, that there's like men and women 0-1, right, or white and black 0-1. So yeah, the work that I'm really interested in is how can we use mathematical models to study race as a construction where you have different, where the model can incorporate many different perspectives on a category like blackness or whiteness. And I mean, just sort of as a summary of the work I'm interested in, I find machine learning methods, because they are so perspectival, they're extremely fluid. I find that there's a certain affordance to machine learning methods to get at this question of how race can have be constructed through many different perspectives. So I think there's a real possibility there.
So there are always steps during the process, even when you're using a computer program, where a human might intervene, like, for example, when deciding how to properly categorize certain types of words or even specific words, right? I don't use those sorts of programs, but I imagine that you have to feed them with data and you can decide how it will organize the data.
Right. Yeah, exactly. This process of modeling, I think, from beginning to end is one that we have to see as really an interaction between the human and the model to really constantly adjust it to assumptions that make sense to humans. So just, you know, specifically, for example, what I find interesting about what we call a classification algorithm is that it's a probabilistic model, meaning that it doesn't inherently classify people or text in a binary way, that it assigns a probability, so it's an infinite scale between 0 and 1. And that's really interesting. So it means that the machine is not necessarily thinking in terms of binary labels. It's thinking about, say, race as a spectrum. So when I use that kind of model to study racial language, I don't assign things into a binary label. I'm interested in understanding the entire spectrum of how the machine understands these categories in a really flexible way. And that takes a lot of intervention at each step of the model making and the interpretation.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes specifically to topics having to do with race and gender, for example, I mean, what are the kinds of phenomena that you can understand better by applying a computer analysis approach?
Right. I think one thing that it's very good at is understanding things both at scale but also over time. So there's been some really interesting papers looking at the evolution of the representation of women in, say, thousands of novels over the past 300 years as a proxy for cultural representation. And again, when you start with the assumption that, say, gender is a socially constructed category, it's your model should be able to account for how that category evolves or is unstable or incoherent in different periods. And the same thing, you can do the same thing for race too, to look at the evolution of the categories. And I think computers are really good at specifying a category, but in a humanist framework, we can really understand over time, again, the kind of contingency, the evolution, instability of these categories. So I think a computer is very good at that because it can handle a lot of data and can look at data over like hundreds of years. So you have to be careful when you do this work, obviously. But so there's been some really interesting research, yeah, in along those lines.
Mm-hmm. And after you get a result, after computer analysis, I guess that you have the data organized in some way or another, and you can get insights into how, for example, the categories of racial traits or racial groups have evolved over time. I mean, can you understand things or answer questions like, for example, when did racism in a particular country started, how it evolved, if racism has been in decline, and things like that?
Right. Yeah, I should say up front that from a more qualitative critical perspective, you know, we always have to be really careful in terms of, right, when we even say something like racism itself is a kind of historical construct. So these methods are really hard to put together with a humanist, like say a critical race perspective, but I think it's possible and we should keep on doing this kind of work. So I would say Certainly, right? We can look at, say, representations of, say, Chinese people in America over the past couple hundred years. And using a model, we can see how that representation, based on visual and literary text, how those representations have changed over time. Again, though, from a kind of critical perspective, I think some people are still wary about these methods because they worry that this is what we call reifying stereotypes, right? We're kind of promoting stereotypes. So I would say have the caveat that this work is always very aware that these stereotypes, these representations or constructions and so forth. So what we're studying is not at all the people themselves. We're studying the media cultural representations. We're trying to operationalize those ideas and then, yes, studying them over time. But again, it's really difficult work because you have to control for a lot of potential confounders to make sure that you're not just repeating stereotypes, that you are finding a signal in the data. And you could say something like, yes, like representations of Chinese people in America, like it changed the 1960s in this convincing way. So that's a goal, but it's difficult work.
Yeah, and I even imagine that it might be even more difficult because over time, even the words that people use as pejoratives against, for example, a given race, like for example, before people in the United States used the word nigger, for example, right? But nowadays, that is basically understood as something that is not. I mean, people don't like it, right? But they can still be racist applying other terms, for example.
Right, that's a good example, right? That I think someone from a more critical tradition would want to know, for example, what we call unmarked, versions of racism or benevolent racism, that the study is just a part of this, is just a part of the story that, we have to keep on making these models more complex to detect latent, unmarked forms of racial discourse or racism and so forth. Again, though, I think, it's challenging, but it's really worth doing. Like, this is really new, interesting, important research. And again, it's hard to do. And there's a lot of caveats, but if we can do it, to me, I'm really interested in putting that research into dialogue with, socioeconomic data, right? That looking at the relationship between the evolution of economic conditions for immigrants or minority groups compared to the evolution of representations at scale, we can really get at some really interesting questions.
So, since in your work you're trying to understand cultural phenomena and cultural transmission as well, and since you're focused mostly on literary studies, I mean, I'm not sure if this is a fair question, but isn't it the case that the types of mediums that you analyze, like for example, books, newspapers, I imagine, and so on, I mean, it is limited also to the people that read them or are exposed to information through those mediums, right?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, and I think this question of readership, these are, again, there's just, getting traction on all these questions is really hard. So, after you can make an argument about, say, the evolution of representations of something in news, like, say, print culture, right? So, language-based culture, there's this question of, like, what are you really proving, right? Because, this is restricted to people that are literate, people who bother to read newspapers or books, which is, increasingly a smaller amount of population. So I would say, again, it's about restricting your claims and your questions to a reasonable frame. So I would say, in the first half of the 20th century, I find books and newspapers a good repository for what people are really thinking and how people are writing. I think for today, I think, increasingly I work on internet data where I think, looking at Reddit or Twitter is a better representation of, a language proxy for, how people are thinking about things. So, yeah, when I work on novels and so forth, I tend to work more historically in periods where books and novels and print culture mattered a bit more. But yeah, I think after, say, 1990, I think, it's probably a good idea to pivot to thinking about internet data, online culture and so forth. So yeah, it's a really good point. And I don't really work on visual culture, but I have colleagues who are using these methods for film and television. But you know, not everyone watches films, not everyone watches television. So it's really about a group of scholars working together to specify problems and questions and trying to accumulate a broader picture of how culture works. But it's going to take, you know, many, many, many researchers.
Sure. Yeah, I was just wondering that maybe, I mean, if we're studying cultural phenomena, I'm not saying that, of course, intellectuals and erudite people and people who read that become politicians, for example, that they don't have a huge influence on society and influence also how people who even don't read think. I'm not saying that at all. Of course, they have a huge impact on society. I'm just wondering if maybe the way they think about certain phenomena, if it wouldn't differ a little bit from them to, the rest of society, for example.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's a question that, literary scholars have really struggled with, that, you know, we believe that writers are good proxies for the people they write about, right? But that's probably not entirely true, that writers are really well educated. So even say a writer who writes about working class subjects, the writer is probably very different from the working class people he or she writes about. So I think what helps though, and what these methods are good at, is they're really good at you're able to compare really different kinds of data sets or corpora. So newspaper discourse is a kind of discourse. Discourse in novels is a kind of discourse compared to, say, like fan fiction or whatever, right? And I think these models, because they're so precise, we can look at how these different corpora, these data sets, produce different perspectives on society. So yeah, we don't really have a good account of specifically what makes novels, you know, at scale different from other kinds of, right, cultural discourses. So that's part of the project, right? Understanding better what writers do differently than, say, normal people. But I mean, ultimately, is there ever like a perfect kind of corpus to like represent the mind of society? I don't think so. Yeah, but yeah, it's a good question. Like, what does culture really do? Like, who's it for?
Yeah. Right. And in terms of cultural transmission, I mean, what are the kinds of questions that these approaches allow for you to answer? Because I mean, when we think about cultural transmission, we're thinking about how information is disseminated in a given society among people, how it is transmitted between different individuals. And I'm asking you this also because I've already had on the show several different cultural evolutionists. I mean, people that study cultural evolution, and they apply a little bit a biological framework. And I mean, I was just thinking about if this sort of work allows for you to understand, for example, the cognitive mechanisms that are behind cultural transmission.
Right. Yeah. I find, yeah, that work is really fascinating. I would say, that work is great. I read it and I think what they're doing is fascinating. I think the perspective that a literary cultural studies scholar would take is somewhat different from like a biologist or like a cognitive scientist. We're somewhat less interested in explaining the cognitive mechanisms by which certain ideas or whatever pick up in society. It's a little bit more descriptive, or the question of causality is more looking at the kind of agency of specific ideas or language patterns and so forth. So historically, for a long time, literary studies scholars have been interested in the diffusion of specific cultural concepts or styles. So like, say, modernism was a style. And then, you know, there are all these arguments about how it started somewhere and then diffuses across the world. And these are important questions to answer. Also, like, say, rap, hip hop, right? That began a specific place in America, and its diffusion tells us something about human creativity and how, you know, humans respond to things. To me, the usefulness or the promise of cultural analytics is, again, I think more descriptive, in that we have so much data, we can just understand more precisely, describe in better, in clearer terms, the movement of specific tropes or ideas or artistic patterns or styles. So Yeah, it's less interested in kind of creating a model of cultural evolution, like trees or like whatever, and almost more, it's a bit more modest, perhaps I would describe it, in that we're just trying to describe better the movement and transmission of cultural patterns and ideas.
And does it also allow for you to understand why certain ideas are more culturally successful than others, for example?
I think I know. Yeah, I read a lot of research from sociologists and various scientists. There, you know, this is an important question, especially from a kind of commercial perspective, right? My understanding is that people have a hard time figuring it out. It's one of these extremely. I know Duncan Watts has written about this, and network models have not been entirely successful in really getting at that question. I would say humanists somewhat shy away from looking at a kind of mechanistic explanation that we really believe a lot in, like, contingency, right, and kind of arbitrariness and so forth. So I think humanists shy away from those kinds of descriptions because it has this kind of danger, kind of reifying, right, and certain beliefs about, like, you know, this kind of idea will be viral or whatever. But to be fair, I am interested in these ideas, but I think more historically that. I feel that we can possibly create more robust historical models if we look at the past and try to understand. Like, I think we're on a little bit more sound ground in terms of not creating universal explainers, but just understanding in this historical context with these various parameters, this idea was very successful, and that might be useful in some sense.
And I mean, the type of material that you produce, the studies that you've done, and other people in your area, do you think that they could in any way be integrated with other disciplines, even from the sciences? I mean, like, for example, anthropology? Because I'm asking you this because nowadays there are many different people out there trying to have a more, what they call a consilient approach, that is trying to have an integration of all the disciplines, if they can, and even the humanities with the sciences. I mean, do you think that could help in that process?
That's my great hope. And one of the things I find really promising about humanists beginning to use more mathematical models and computation and data is that it allows us to have join in that conversation because pretty much all scientists they use mathematical models. A large portion of social sciences they also use these methods. And if you don't use those methods, it's hard to have a conversation across those disciplines, to have a conversation where everyone kind of shares some of the same assumptions and so forth. And I think historically, the humanities has seen themselves as somewhat other to the sciences in that we only do qualitative research. But I find very exciting and promising that we are now a part of that kind of methodological discussion. And yeah, I work a lot with scientists, and it's really interesting to say compare, say, a principal components analysis on the human body versus like a novel, looking at how variance works. And so yeah, I would say it falls along two directions. I think some digital humanists, cultural analytics people, they're very interested in like these potential laws of art versus, like, say, other laws like in astronomy, physics, and so forth. So that's something that's one area. And the other area that I'm somewhat more interested in is communicating more with economists, political scientists, trying to bring into their framework what we would call cultural data. So obviously, they model tons of economic and political data, but this question of operationalizing things like cultural representation, reader responses, things like that, I think will really open up, basically bring in culture into the whole framework of the social sciences in a robust way. So I think it's great. I really, it's going to help us, address some really interesting questions.
Yeah, you refer to the laws of art, right? And I guess that one of the things that came to my mind is that maybe, I mean, the humanities could benefit from some level of integration with the sciences, in the sense, like, for example, certain aspects of human psychology that help us understand how people communicate ideas to one another, the ideas that are stickier, let's say, and things like that. That, I mean, maybe the humanities could benefit a bit more from being integrated with, for example, psychology, anthropology, even a little bit of biology, maybe by understanding how our brains work and things like that.
Yeah, I know that you often have a lot of neuroscientists and cognitive scientists. So another strain of this work is, I think they call it cognitive literacy studies. I know a little bit about this, but yeah, it's precisely people studying fMRIs and things like that to understand better that when a human has a response to a work of art, can we quantify that? Can we better understand that at the scale of the brain? I think all of this work is really interesting because what we have in common is a desire to understand better human different perspectives and angles. I just think it's been a somewhat slow process and a somewhat contentious process because we have this sort of myth of the two cultures, right? Science versus, you know, the humanities or the arts. And it just takes, you know, as with any paradigm shift, it just takes a lot of time and a lot of work for people to kind of start breaking down those barriers. But yeah, I really think we have to do it, and we'll just know a lot more about humans and culture in the process.
And even within the humanities themselves, I mean, these sort of more quantitative approaches, they can also give or turn them a little bit more objective, right? Because, for example, when we look back in time and the work that people do in disciplines like history, maybe there are some historical phenomena that with these kinds of approaches would be better explained instead of simply just having experts in a specific epoch, for example, or era, where they know virtually 100% that happened there, and then they are just trying to even sometimes come up with a solid narrative to why things happen as they did.
Yeah, I mean, you're really putting your finger on the real, again, the crux of the debate in the humanities about the importation of scientific methods, where I mean, a lot of people in literary studies, people who study aesthetics, sort of valorize the kind of subjectivist expert approach that you have people that have really good aesthetic judgment, have read a lot of books, and their kind of interpretation should carry weight because, you know, and there's many critiques of this, right? A lot of this is associated with class, you know, education, background, that, yeah, so everything you're saying, I'm really sympathetic to, but I think that it can be dangerous to restrict knowledge in the humanities to people that are deemed experts, right? But through mechanisms that are tied to prestige, you know, authority, where you teach and things like that. So, yeah, but again, it's really difficult because a lot of people feel that there is no objectivity in the evaluation or the analysis of artworks. So it's really contentious that objectivity is often a kind of dirty word in the humanities. I still think there's a place for really subjective individual aesthetic judgment where, you know, there are professors who have really refined aesthetic tastes and they teach students the best way to kind of interpret a Shakespeare play. But I do think there should be another dimension or wing of the humanities where we do work where there can be some shared standards of judgment and valuation that we can produce things that look a little bit more objective, less contingent on individual subjective opinions or judgments. And that could also really help the discipline. But again, I mean, I know it sounds kind of strange because in the sciences, objectivity is always objectively a really good word. But in the humanities, there's a lot of skepticism towards that concept. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's one of the reasons why I brought up the example of history, because, for example, when you talk about the arts, I mean, I can't see that someday in the future people will be able to objectively evaluate a piece of art, for example, a movie, a painting, whatever. But when it comes to history, since we're talking about historical, political phenomena, social phenomena, etc. I mean, many times it's the case that we have scholars that are very well informed on a given historical context or historical place, for example, but then we have conflicting interpretations of the same data, let's say, that they have access to. So, I mean, maybe a little bit more of some sort of objective approach in that case via mathematical modeling or computer analysis, maybe it would allow for us to get at least a little bit closer to what's the truth, let's say.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just to go back to the first thing you said, though. I mean, I think humanists would reject the idea that we would ever develop objective evaluations of art. But I think one thing that would be appealing is we can develop more agreed upon standards to understand what a work of art is doing. So I think this question of taste and judgment is always going to be forever subjective. I think there's no way of getting around that. But again, a better account of how works of art, what precisely they're doing, with the help of machines or whatever, right, at scale, we might be able to create a better account of something that's inherently subjective. Yeah, and this ties to your point about history. I think that's right too, right? That, right, we'll always quarrel over the meaning of a historical event or why something happened. But yeah, I think having more data, not to impose an objective belief on anyone, but just having different resources to understand more precisely what happened, right? Because we'll, you know, like, it's also a question of taste almost, like why something happened, whether it's good or bad, that is just going to be forever inherently subjective. But at least you can base your judgment on solider grounds. You know, I find, you know, like sabermetrics, like Moneyball, stuff like that, really interesting in that, you know, we'll always debate whether who the best basketball player is, right? Or who the best baseball player is. But Moneyball, sabermetrics allows us to have that debate, I think, in more productive ways, because we have more agreed upon sets of standards and data. So if you say, like, this person is the best player because, you know, they're the most efficient, right? You can say, yeah, the data supports this definition of efficiency. So the debate becomes less asinine, endless, right? Less maddening, like my opinion versus your opinion, and more based on something solid, as you're saying. And I find that's a more productive way to have a debate rather than the endless slinging back and forth of opinions. Yeah.
Well, I use the word truth. I mean, getting closer to the truth, maybe that's a bit unfair, because even in science, I mean, scientists also don't say that a given explanation or a given theory is, we are sure that it's 100% truth. It's just that step by step, we get closer to something that resembles reality, let's say, or that is closer to reality. So maybe, I mean, when it comes to history and other disciplines of the humanities, I mean, through those approaches, maybe we could at least start being able to falsify certain hypotheses. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, something that was, so I began my retraining in the sciences, specifically natural language processing and, you know, fundamentals, the statistics, is through that study and collaborating with statisticians and computational linguists and so forth, is, yeah, I was really surprised the amount of debate, right, that inheres in any scientific discovery or any kind of scientific argument that, and especially the more you scale up with complicated statistical models and especially machine learning models, the more fuzziness enters. And, you know, my statistician collaborator often describes statistics in many ways as more of an art, right? That, you know, you can, yeah, I think you can be fairly certain within a certain confidence interval that this is true or not true. But in terms of what does that really mean, like your interpretation of this output, you can be 99% sure that you can reject this null hypothesis. But again, the meaning of that result, right, and the effect size, just because it's within a certain confidence interval, the effect size could be tiny to the point of it being trivial. And then the interpretation there's no meaningful interpretation. So that was very humbling and really interesting. But yeah, I think we can get closer to discarding arguments that are so unverifiable or just clearly false or in that domain of so unlikely as to be impossible to credit. I think that's very fascinating, very useful, because then we can kind of focus our debates on the real things we need to be debating, the things that truly are in that domain of indeterminacy that we're not sure, but also then discard arguments that are clearly like preposterous, right, and don't make sense. Yeah.
So going back for a minute to the specific questions that you're trying to answer through your work, I mean, again, you've been studying phenomena having to do with race, for example. I mean, could you tell us a little bit about the questions that you've been exploring? And I mean, I'm not sure if you can say if in the United States, through literary studies, you know that people have been really getting less racist or not. I mean, could you tell us something about that?
Right. So, you know, my colleagues and I were in the relatively early stages of this sort of work. So we're still trying to incrementally just get at some, you know, fundamental questions. So one project that I've recently finished and will be published as a book soon is really just trying to get at the low-hanging fruit questions before we get to more complicated causal questions. But I'm just interested in a certain period of American culture, the post-war period, where I discovered that say literary culture, say publishers and book reviews, there's a lot of racial inequalities. So mainstream book publishers are like 96-97% white in terms of the authors that they publish, which is a staggering inequality. And so just as, you know, a very simple question is, you know, does this sort of inequality at this sort of demographic level, at say publishers, does it translate into you know, effects in content, right? Does it translate into stereotypes, right? Racist representations, right? In the actual material that's published, right? And this tells a story about racial inequality in culture as it manifests both at the demographic level, but also at the level of art, right? Like ideas, representation, language. And then, yeah, questions are like, you know, how sticky is it, right? Are these, when you have negative representations, right? What constitutes these representations, how sticky, what can force them to change. So for example, I'm interested in this one study. If you hire, so Random House, this publisher, they hired its first black editor in the 1980s. Does that have any effect in terms of reversing patterns of racial bias and discrimination and racism in the culture itself, in the books they publish? I find that it doesn't, you know. So one of the things I'm interested in is this question of inequality in culture at the level of ideas, and what does it take to change that, right? How sticky, how durable are these, you know, ideas? So yeah, one thing that I'm interested in is sort of bad ideas, racist ideas. What do they look like within culture? How durable, how sticky are they? And what can you do to kind of disrupt those patterns? So that's one thing I've been interested in.
Are you also interested in understanding maybe how negative racial stereotypes or negative racial ideas might change over time? Because, for example, since people get to notice that certain ideas no longer work or no longer have an effect on people, mm-hmm. Could it be the case that racist people over time try other approaches?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Just based on the one study that I've done so far, looking at 50 years of a book publisher that, again, is, you know, 96% white, and I find that descriptions of, say, black characters, black people in stories tends to be very stereotypical, very negative. Yeah, one interesting thing I found is compared to descriptions of white characters, negative stereotypes around black characters, black people in stories is really stable. Like, there's not a lot of creativity or innovation that, when I model it, the kind of variance you see over time is very, very low, that as a kind of discourse is highly stable, it's unchanging over time, which I found interesting, especially if you compare it to a baseline of how, say, white people are described in stories. There's a ton of variance that in a kind of cultural environment, say a publisher, it sounds terrible, but like, you know, there's a lot more dynamism in terms of positive representations of white people, that there's a lot of creativity, that there's, you know, they're constantly changing. They're imagined as, say, religious, and then as intellectuals, and then as parents, you know, it's constantly evolving. But yeah, negative stereotypes, people will just kind of focus in on a handful of tropes, and they're remarkably stable. I mean, they change slightly, like the vernacular, you know, so certain, obviously, ethnic slurs, racial slurs, but in terms of the core idea, there's not a lot of variance. And, you know, one theory I'm interested in is that, you know, with minorities, the space of imagining them is very narrow, whereas a space of imagining positively, say, the majority group, like white people, there's a lot of variance. There's a lot of opportunity for representation, which itself, to me, is a kind of inequality. So, I think stereotypes are really enduring. And so at least in terms of print culture, I find that negative racial stereotypes are surprisingly uncreative and interesting. But the last thing I'll mention is I'm starting to do more work on the internet, and I'm interested in, you know, how different mediums produce different kinds of, you know, stereotypes, you know, so that I'm finding that it could be that print culture tends to have a lot of entropy in terms of, you know, the evolution of ideas, but the internet seems really dynamic. So I'm starting to do work on, you know, the evolution of, say, racial stereotypes, racial representations on the internet compared to, say, newspapers or novels. And it could be that, again, different media produce different forms of cultural evolution over time. Yeah.
And how do you classify a given representation as racist? I mean, is it the case that you only classify as racist the situations where, for example, a particular person is represented in a negative way? Or do you also classify as racist, for example, if a given book completely lacks black people, for example?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think different forms of, one of my collaborators, Andrew Piper, who's my colleague, we've been working on a bigger project on cultural inequality. So I think one way to encapsulate all this is this question of inequality, where stereotypes and discrimination are a part of it, but inequality is a sort of like a broader umbrella term. Because yeah, I think it's all those things. I think, you know, negative representations of black people, that's clearly a form of oppression, bias, inequality, but yet also a kind of invisibility that stories that, you know, there's a lot of research on Hollywood and the underrepresentation of non-white people. And I mean, what's interesting to me is all these things at different scales connect. So the demographic question of, so Hollywood has very few black female directors, and then how that ties to how many black female characters, actors are in the stories, and then how they're discursively represented in the stories. To me, this is part of the bigger problem of cultural inequality. And they all really fit together. If you model these things together, you'll discover that there's a lot of correlations and, you know, mixed causalities. But to me, the bigger problem is one of what we call cultural inequality. Yeah.
So let us just explore one last topic in the interview. You've already alluded to the fact that you're also studying internet phenomena and cultural transmission via the internet. What are the sorts of places on the internet that you're most focused on? So for example, are you focused mostly on social media?
One kind of contextual thing is, I think social scientists and scientists, like tons of, there's endless researchers now working on the internet, obviously, and because the text is so easily gettable and it's typically often relatively clean, and machine learning methods are really good for text, like natural language processing, there's a ton of people working on this. So the question to me is, what does kind of a humanist perspective bring to all this? And tons of people working on Twitter, Facebook, Reddit. So on the one hand, we are looking at all the popular platforms. So we're looking at Reddit, Twitter, fan fiction, Goodreads, YouTube, text data, stuff like that. But I would say, again, you start getting this data and you instantly realize there's just so much of it that even if you just only study Reddit, it's so vast. So to me, an important question is what is your question that you're bringing to this data? Because I think it's, is as vast as the internet is as vast as like society itself. And so a political scientist can look at Reddit data in a totally different way than I would look at it. So the kinds of questions that we're looking at are more specifically humanist in terms of when we look at Reddit, we're interested in this question of, say, imagined communities. How do people on Reddit imagine a world, their ideas? So that to us is about a really humanist question about how do people construct a world using language and how do they imagine meaning emerging from these worlds? So but yeah, we're also really interested in things like 4chan, kind of like extremist groups, right? I mean, I think everyone's interested in these emergent right-wing groups. How do they imagine worlds and use language to create realities and things like that? Yeah.
Do you know if there are any major ways by which the internet might be changing how people interact with one another?
Yeah, to me, this is, I think, one of the really big, interesting questions that I'm really interested in. And another thing I want to mention is that, when we're looking at internet data, we're always looking at it historically. So we're always trying to create models looking at earlier cultural platforms and forums that are kind of precede the internet. And it's incredibly difficult work to control for all these confounders. But if you can kind of create a model where you have kind of pre and post internet, then you can get this question of how did the internet induce new ways of expression, right? And then from there, you can get that questions of human behavior. But it's really difficult because, you can look at, say, human behavior, like social network behavior on Reddit, right? How do people talk to each other? But, there's not really something like that from before the internet that you could control for all these confounders, right? That you could say confidently that, the Reddit is different. We're trying to build models that we can actually create that kind of model for pre and post internet in terms of at least expression and language. But again, it's really, really difficult. But to me, that's one of the truly most interesting questions. So for example, a really low hanging fruit question that's incredibly difficult to answer is something like, did the internet, do platforms like 4chan and Reddit, did that encourage people to be more aggressively racist in their language, right? Compared to, say, newspapers and novels before the internet? To me, a really clean, simple question, a really important question that we all want to know the answer to, but from a kind of scientific perspective, incredibly hard to model because of all these confounders and so forth. But that's precisely the kind of stuff that I'm interested in.
Well, I don't know if this idea makes sense or not, but I imagine that because people on the internet, it's much easier for them to be anonymous in
Yes.
some way or another, or even to create, let's say, characters or personas. I mean, maybe it's easier for them to, in the internet, express themselves in ways that they wouldn't feel at ease doing the same way in their real lives.
Yeah, that seems like like a really testable hypothesis, and my guess too would be that it would be true. There's been some good research. There's a good book called Everybody Lies from a researcher that showed that it's based on Google searches, and what people Google search is far contradicts survey response, survey data in terms of what people say to a survey researcher, what they say in public versus what they Google in terms of sexual preferences, sexual habits, things like that. So there's already, we're starting to build the evidence to show that, the internet affords more kind of radical expressive behavior. But in terms of, that's just a hypothesis though, we need better tests to really, like, is that really true? Like, I'm not sure. Like, that seems intuitively true, right? And that would be my hypothesis as well. But even if it is true, there's just like, more intense questions to get after, right? Like, what does that really mean, right? Does that, again, as you're saying, does that translate into actual behavior, right? Does, you know, so people definitely say crazy, violent stuff on the internet. Is that leading to an uptick in actual, like, violent activities in society? Like, that to me is not entirely intuitively true or false, right? And I think that's the next frontier of research, that that when you're able to express yourself freely, does that change your behavior? But, you know, I have to say, everyone, you know, people have been writing novels and stories for a long time, you know, making fantasies. And, you know, is that that much different from the internet? You know, the internet is just a place where people create fictions and fantasies. I mean, people have been doing that forever, right? Like, with stories and books. So I want to do that study, right? People should do that study. We should test these hypotheses. But I'm a little bit resistant to the idea that the internet changed everything, right? That seems a little bit too convenient.
Yeah, and then we get into the question of, the dichotomy or the gap between what people say and how they behave, right? Because, for example, if there are many more people on the internet that are racist, for example, and then in their daily lives they don't mistreat black people, for example, or something like that, in what ways would you deal with that kind of information? Would you say that people are really racist or not?
Right. Yeah. This question of what's interesting to me about the internet is that it kind of generalized this idea that language is a kind of behavior, right? And, you know, so if you say something horrible and racist on the internet, it's going to have a lot of consequences in your life. You'll probably, like, lose your job, right? This question, I think it's interesting, again, that, you know, even before the internet, with, say, stories, right, people have always been living in fantasies and taking comfort in stories to live lives or say things that they can't really say or do in their real life. That's just been a condition for humans, right, since, you know, we've been making stories. And now we see it more ubiquitously on the internet, right, where now we see everyone just makes fantasies and fictions online. And you can get a lot of trouble for that. But yeah, I mean, how does that, is that the way that translates into people's actual lives, is it really different than in the past, right? So in the past, you know, people would, you know, read these crazy stories, you know, spend all night reading crazy stories to get something out about that they can't express in their own actual lives. Again, like, there seems to be a continuity between the internet and previous forms of story and fiction making. So I'm not entirely convinced that something disastrous is happening with the internet that's different than in the past. Yeah. But again, hypothesis, right? You have to test these hypotheses.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so Dr. So, before we go, what are the best places on the internet for people to find your work?
I would like to more broadly promote the work of my colleagues, actually, because this is a kind of new field. It's probably akin to, like, neuroscience in the 80s, where I think it's exciting, it's new, there's a lot of great work, but it's new, so people don't really know a lot about it. I would describe my field, my research, as cultural analytics. It's a new field. There's a journal called the Journal of Cultural Analytics. There are some really excellent scholars in this field. So my colleagues, Lauren Klein, Catherine Bodie, Ted Underwood, Andrew Piper, and many others. I'm not sort of doing justice to, but those are not bad people to start with. I would say certainly check out my work. Just go to my website. You can just Google my name, Richard Jean So. But more broadly, I would say check out this emerging new field of research, because I think it could be really profoundly impactful, a lot like neuroscience, right, in the 80s, how that really changed how we understand the human mind and human existence. The field is cultural analytics, and I think it's great, and I hope people will check it out more.
Okay, great. So I will be leaving links to your work in the description box of the interview so that people can go and check it out. It's very interesting and I recommend it. So, Dr. So, thank you again for taking the time to come on the show, and it was a real pleasure to talk to you. I really loved the conversation.
So. Yeah, me too. Yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, take care. Thank you.
Hi everybody, thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've started this channel in February 2018 and have been putting out regular interviews with academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. So to keep the channel sustainable, I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. Any amount, even just $1, would already be a great help. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and subscribe to the channel. You can also support me on PayPal or Subscribestar. All of the links are in the description box of the interview. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Perelga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Chantel Gelinas, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunda, Brian Rivera, Lucas Stafiniak, Sergio Condriano, Janne Henninen, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, John Connors, Adam Castle, Vega Giddy, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, David Diaz, Dr. Jerry Muller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, and Bo Weingart, and also my three producers, Izar Webb, Rosie, and Jim Frank. Thank you for all.